You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hi, this is Tanya Pinkins, and you're listening to my podcast, You Can't Say That, the show where you can, on the Broadway Podcast Network. My dad used to always call me a square. That was because I was like a square. I was a total nerd. I liked to read. I spent all my time reading. I didn't go to parties. I didn't drink. I didn't smoke. I think I didn't drink or smoke because my mother was a 5-pack-a-day smoker. And I didn't like how people acted when they were drinking. And I just assessed myself at a very young age as being someone who had an addictive personality. So I was like, if I start that, I'm going to do it so much that it's not going to be good. So I never did. So I didn't hang out with people after school or ever go to the clubs. And in fact, I was married with children by the time I was 25 years old. So 2 years ago, when I had my first entheogen, which is the new word for it, or psychedelic experience, it was profound. And before I did it, I did all this research. I was reading because I was like, you know what? If I do this, I could die. I might go crazy, and I won't even know I've gone crazy, and I will never come back. So it was very scary for me. So I did all this research, and, you know, the people were like Terrence McKenna and Michael Pollan and, you know, South America and mushrooms and just all this stuff. It was like I couldn't find any black people who were talking about entheogens or psychedelics, like none. And it was very white male. And so I just started this search trying to find where were the people of color who were doing entheogens. And it was really, really hard. I found one man online, and he's going to be on one of my podcasts, Baba Kalinda Iyi. But the first person I found is my next guest. So join me in welcoming from the Drug Policy Alliance. And I'm going to let you say the other name, POC Psychedelic Collective, yes. Ifatayo Harvey. Welcome, Ifatayo.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. So, you know, why are there no people of color in entheogens? Why don't we have any books? Why aren't, you know, can't we find any research about us?
Wow. Well, how much time do you have?
A lot.
Well, I would say the simplest way to say that, to answer that question, is because a lot of our practices around entheogens, you know, existed all throughout the world for centuries, but because of things like colonialism, the war on drugs, a lot of these practices were taken from us. And so, it's particularly for Black folks, African descendants, we come from cultures that were mostly oral history based, right? So a lot of our practices were taken from us, and it's really hard to find any, written documents
And I imagine, as you say that, I think about the Native Americans that I know who say that there are stories that they have never told and will never tell the white people, that they only pass orally to one another. So I think that there's probably some secrecy involved in it. I think of that biblical quote, "For him who has ears, let him hear." And so there are things that just are not shared, because if you are called to it, the message will get to you. Like, I found you.
Yes, yes. I was so surprised when you found me. I was like, wait, who is this person? Like, how did they get my email? And I Googled you, and you're an actress. I was like, wait, this can't be right.
Well, I was, you know, on a mission to understand, because I also had read a lot about melanin as a neurotransmitter and the way melanin and DMT interact. So I just reasoned that whatever the experiences Terrence McKenna and Michael Pollan and these white guys were having, it would not be able to compare to the experiences that people who have more melanin, which is a neurotransmitter that interacts with DMT, would have. So I was like, I want to know what people of color are doing with this, and I want to experience this with people of color.
Yes, that's something that Kalindi, he's very big on, is the melanin and DMT. I don't know a ton about that, but I do know that in my experience, you know, being in drug policy, working with psychedelic organizations, there's not a lot of folks who look like me. When you go to events and conferences, there's no talk of how the war on drugs impacted Black and brown communities or even Indigenous folks. There's really no consideration for race at all. And if you bring it up, you're being seen as divisive and, you know, not really enlightened or whatever, you know, BS there.
Right.
So that really motivated me to create my own space, because I felt like if white folks can't understand our trauma and our pain and our ancestral pain that we carry with us, then how are they going to help us heal from that? And it was really important for me to be able to create a space for folks who really need this type of medicine the most. You know, Black and brown folks, we are so traumatized by this country's history that we don't even realize all the stuff that we're carrying.
Yeah, I had taken a class in Indigenous focusing oriented therapy, which is therapy for people living in genocidal cultures, which we are all living in a genocidal culture. So I read, and it's your story to tell, that you came to being interested in drug policy because of a personal drug thing in your life. Would you tell us what that was?
Sure. So I came into drug policy because my father was convicted of a drug offense when I was about 4 years old, and he was sentenced to 15 years in prison. He served about 8 of those years and was deported in 2004 back to Jamaica. So that's where he lives today. But growing up as a kid, you know, I always, it was like a secret that I was holding in myself. I didn't feel like I could talk to many people about it, really only my mom. And there was just so much stigma around prison and folks with criminal records. So I carried a lot of shame throughout my childhood and didn't really know how to articulate all of that. And so when I came across the Drug Policy Alliance, I was like, whoa, this is like amazing that this organization exists. And I was really lucky that I was able to get an internship with them. And, you know, as soon as I told my story to my would-be supervisor, he was like, oh, yeah, I want you here, like, immediately. So I felt super-duper comfortable at DPA. It's a very unique place because...
What do they do?
Well, we do advocacy and policy work around drug laws and drug policies, mostly in the U.S., but we do some international work. So we do everything from legalizing marijuana to policies around preventing overdose and enacting harm reduction. So it was the first place that I came across that spoke about folks who use drugs, folks who were involved in drug economies, with compassion and without judgment and stigma. And so it's challenged my own perceptions of folks who use different drugs. I come from a family where, you know, alcoholism was common. And even though alcohol is not that stigmatized of a drug, I still have had to unpack a lot of my own biases towards folks who drink. Kind of how you were talking about your mom and the 5-pack-a-day thing, that's definitely something that, you know, when you see that in your childhood, it stays with you, and you're always like, it's in the back of your mind that, oh, that could be me or something like that. So being at DPA was really, it was a healing experience to be able to talk about, you know, my trauma about being separated from my dad.
Now, you call it drugs, and I tend to mostly call it medicine.
Yeah.
Plant medicine, fungi medicine, animal medicine. Mm-hmm. I've done combo, which is the Brazilian green tree frog, mm-hmm. and some other plants, mm-hmm. and fungi, the psilocybins. Mm-hmm. So I like to call it medicine, mm-hmm. because I think they're teachers. Mm-hmm. So coming with this background and this shame, how do you overcome that internal stigma, shame to even ever try a drug?
that's a really good question. I think growing up, I was kind of like you. Like, I didn't go to parties. I read. I had a part-time job. I was super involved in all my clubs at school because I thought that, well, maybe if I'm super obedient and stay out of that stuff, then nothing bad will happen to me, right? And that's kind of, I guess, a control thing, or trying to feel in control. So I stayed away from drugs for the most part in high school, alcohol. I stayed away from that. There were some moments here and there, and one of my friends senior year was like, oh, let's smoke this bowl. And I was like, what is this? And I had a really good experience.
What is a bowl? I don't know what that is.
It's a smoking pipe for
okay,
weed.
What's in it? Oh, okay.
For weed. Yeah, so it's like the glass pipes you see in the bodegas.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So, so we smoked that, and I was just laughing the entire night, and I had a great experience. But even then, I wasn't really trying to seek it out until I got to college my freshman year. And going from South Carolina to Massachusetts was a big adjustment for me, and I was met with more anxiety than I was used to around my schoolwork, and just acclimating myself to being in a very white elite campus. And so I started smoking weed again, probably like my second semester, and it actually helped me a lot.
So it was an anxiety reliever. It was a stress yeah. reliever from being in this hostile environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was able to write my papers better. I was just able to focus on my work and not get bogged down by my anxiety. So I started smoking regularly with my friends. It was like a ritual we had. Like, at the end of the day, we would just go smoke and kind of bitch about our lives, and we'd feel good after that. That was our thing. And I did, you know, at some moments I've definitely felt judged by certain classmates, you know,
for doing marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, they would be like,
you're a pothead.
Yeah, like, stop being high all the time. Like, why do you
did you get good grades?
You know, I maintained my 3.0, so okay. That's all I wanted.
okay.
You know, yeah, I got good grades, and I was awarded student leader of the year my senior year, so I would say that.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I would say that.
The pot didn't hold you back.
Exactly. So, yeah. It was also complicated being a leader on campus and, you know, dabbling in this. I did actually get in trouble once. I got caught on campus.
And what happened?
Me and a bunch of friends were in a room smoking, and someone called the campus police on us. And he's, like, banging on the door. And my friend kind of has a smart mouth. He's like, what's that I smell? And she's like, candles? So we had to write a letter to the house community there, telling them how we negatively impacted their house community and blah blah blah. So it wasn't that big of a deal, but you know, it was still something, and
some shaming,
right. And so I did my internship with EPA.
The EPA?
DPA.
Oh, DPA.
Sorry, DPA, yeah.
And that's why you were in college.
Mm-hmm. Well, my junior year. And then when I got back to Smith, I actually got diagnosed with depression. by, I was seeing a therapist throughout my 4 years at Smith, and during my senior year, my mental health kind of was like dwindling a bit. And then I got diagnosed with depression, and it was almost like a confirmation bias where I was just like, oh, wow. I knew I was depressed, but it's different to hear it from someone else. Mm-hmm. So I felt like I kind of went down like a rabbit hole with that. And then I got invited to speak at the Drug Policy Alliance's International Drug Policy Reform Conference in Denver. So I was doing the keynote opening plenary as a senior in college.
Wow.
And I didn't know what I was getting myself into. They just asked me to speak, and I was like, oh, yeah, sure, no big deal. And then I get there, and they're like, oh, yeah, you're going to be speaking in front of 1,100 people. And I'm like, okay. Oh, my God. I was so nervous, but I went up there and did it. And, you know, it was really, again, very healing for me to have that talk and very cathartic because there were so many people coming up to me afterwards saying, like, wow, like, I really relate to your story. It was folks who were men who had gotten out of prison, and they were, you know, feeling my story from the perspective of a parent, or people who were working with kids who had parents in prison. So it was a really good feeling I got from in that moment. And I made a lot of connections, but at the same time, I was still dealing with this depression of mine, right? And so later at that conference, I had the chance to go see a panel where it was a bunch of psychedelic researchers, and they were talking about end-of-life treatment with psychedelics. So folks with terminal illnesses, things like that. And it was really fascinating and insightful for me because a lot of the things they were saying about folks who are facing death, I kind of, it resonated with me a lot. The anxiety, like the constant anxiety and stress and things like that. So when I got back to school, I started asking my friends, I'm like, so if I wanted to do mushrooms, how would I do them? I started asking them for tips and stuff because they had all done it before. And I was kind of the one who was just like, I don't really feel the need to, so I'm not going to. And then I finally was like, okay, I need to do this, because the other option was to, you know, they were going to prescribe me antidepressants. And my mom's an herbalist, so that was something she always, like, wanted me to avoid growing up, is, like, I don't want you to get hooked on those things, and not to stigmatize people who do use those and do need those. But for me, that was, like, a really big step, and I wasn't sure if it was for me. So I was like, I'd rather try something else. So I went with mushrooms, and I got my hands on some, and I remember getting one of my friends to be my sitter with me. So she was sober, and I cut them all up and put them in a peanut butter sandwich.
How much did you have?
I took 3.5 grams the first
time.
3.5 grams
your first time. Now, Terrence McKenna says 7 grams is the heroic dose. You took 3.5. Most people I know, they buy an eighth and mm-hmm. they share an eighth.
Mm-hmm.
You took 3.5 grams your first time. Okay, tell us about the first journey.
Oh, man. So, yes. Oh, man. So Smith's campus is really great for tripping and journeying because it's an arboretum. So it's really beautiful in the fall. And so one Saturday morning, you know, after I ate my peanut butter sandwich.
So you did it in the daytime. You didn't do it at night?
Yeah, I didn't do it at night. I didn't know about Kalindi's method at this time. I was just like, okay, I want to do, you know, have some time in my day to, like, kind of recover. So we went on this nature trail that was really beautiful around this pond. And
you're walking on mushrooms.
We're walking.
Okay, did you get the nausea? Did you get the chills? Or did that skip you?
I did. So we're walking, and I start to notice the leaves and the plants are, like, glistening. And I see the water, like, glistening and moving, and everything's breathing. And I'm telling my friend, like, oh, I think it's kicking in. And she's like, okay. And so we go and sit down in this field, and I just start feeling, like, overwhelmed with the nausea.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh my God, I'm going to have diarrhea pretty soon. So, I asked my friend, I was like, will you judge me if I go take a shit right now? And she's like, no, no, I won't. I mean, God bless
this
her.
This is a good friend. Are you still friends?
Yes. She's, oh my God, she's amazing. Oh my God. So I went to try to go and nothing was coming out. So I'm just like, okay. And then I see this, like, this bunch of roots, like, wrapped up. And when I was tripping, it turns into a face. And it's, like, talking to me. It's like, give me your vomit. Give it, like, telling me to, like, to throw up, basically. It's like, just give it to me. Like, you're going to be okay. Just, like, give me your vomit. And so I was like, okay. So I just vomited. And I felt better, but I still was like, I want to just lay down somewhere. So me and my friend, we went back to my dorm, and we were in my room, and all of a sudden, I just felt really great for a while. I was feeling really happy and giggly, and that's when it really started to kick in. And I remember, you know, kind of expecting that the depression stuff to come up, like something, like a memory or something to come up, but not a lot was coming up. I do remember I picked up a bookmark that my dad had given my mom, and it was a poem called Footsteps. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've ever.
Yeah, I do.
Oh, you know
you
it.
Want to tell it? Do you know it? Off the top of your head? It's a really beautiful poem.
Do you know it?
I don't know it off the top of my head, but we can find it.
Well, I know the gist of
it.
The gist. Yeah. So basically the guy's having a conversation with God and he's saying, you know, I'm seeing these footsteps in the sand and you were with me through all these tough times, but through my hardest time you left me. I'm only seeing one set of footsteps. Like, why'd you abandon me? And God responds, he says, I was carrying you. Mm. And I just broke down crying. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, like, I want to be carried. I want to be held. And it was a kind of a cathartic moment for me there too. And I just like cried. And it was good because I felt like I couldn't really cry in a long time. And then 5 minutes later, I'm just giggling again. So, so my emotions were just like, I was really surprised by that. I'm like, wait, how can I go from being sad to laughing again? This is so weird. But, you know, now I realize that mushrooms kind of make you process things a little bit easier than
faster. I think of all of the entheogens as really intense psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. And you're doing it with yourself. Whereas most of us spend our lifetime working our stuff out on other people, projecting it on them, working as if they are the problem.
Yep.
When you're doing an entheogen, you go right into your stuff and you are facing it and there is no one there but you, and you either are going to fight that or you're going to be like, okay, like.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
For the first couple of times I did mushrooms, I went through a couple of hours of self-loathing.
Mm.
And it was like, I wasn't resisting. I'm like, okay, so let's be self-loathing. How self-loathing are we? How awful are we? And I just, because I had read that it, you know, was important not to resist whatever came. Like if it was death, you had to go with the death. But that the most important thing was to not fight it. And I don't want to interrupt you, but
no.
I want to say that I had a friend who was an alcoholic, and I wanted to introduce him to mushrooms. And his experience of mushrooms, he's a Brit, and he's very polite, and the manners are very important. And, you know, all I could say is it just always felt fake to me.
Mm-hmm.
And when he did the mushrooms, what came up was murderous rage.
Wow.
And for me, it was like the first time I truly saw him. I could see the spirit of him as a warrior spirit who was born to die for causes and that he believed in. And so I was like, come on, who do you want to murder? Who else? Come on, come on, come on. And, you know, once it was over, he was like, I don't like that. I don't ever want to do that again. Where did all that bitter and murderous rage come from? I mean, I'm not going to do that again if that's what's going to happen. And I'm like, the mushrooms didn't do that to you. The mushrooms just got rid of all this mask that you cover it up with.
Right,
so if
right.
you haven't dealt with all that murderous rage, it's going to come up again until you process all of that.
Exactly.
So back to you and you were laughing and crying. Oh. And
So... yeah, I was just laughing and crying, and then the rest of my trip was pretty relaxing and just very light and fun. I was expecting it to be more heavy than that, and I just, after that one moment where I was crying, it was just, I felt very light, and I also felt like I was reminded why I'm alive, because I saw all the plants and stuff breathing, and I was just seeing so much life around me. I was like, wow, there's a reason to live. You know, there's so much beauty in the world. And I feel like when you are, you know, depressed or, you know, dealing with other mental health challenges, you have like these glasses on that kind of make you see the world through like gray, you know, like there's a cloud over your head, like everywhere's cloudy and gray. And then when I took mushrooms, I felt like I was taking those off and seeing everything in like Technicolor all of a sudden. And so it definitely, it was like a boost, like a reset button was hit with me. And so that was my first mushroom journey. And so I've, you know, since then have journeyed and experimented with different doses. I haven't really gone higher.
Than 3.5.
No. But that said, I've had some experiences where I've taken smaller doses, but I guess the mushrooms are more potent. And it was the visuals I was getting was like crazy. And then I've also had instances where I've taken smaller doses, but I felt like the lessons that I was getting was more impactful.
Tell me about some of the lessons you've gotten on your journeys.
Yeah. So most recently, I planned a retreat in New Mexico with 5 other women. And this is my first time doing like mushrooms in a ceremony.
Okay.
So we did something called 9-cup ceremony where we drank 9 cups of mushroom tea.
Okay.
And so this was a lighter dose than I was used to. I wasn't getting the visuals.
Was there a curandera, a shaman leading it, or were you leading it?
I wasn't leading it. There was a woman, she's Black American, she was leading it. And she's just been learning from other shamans and curandera. So she's pretty young, but she's very, very good at holding
powerful,
the space.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so when I was on this trip, because it was such a light trip and I wasn't getting visuals, I started getting frustrated and everyone else basically fell asleep. There was like 3 of us who kind of stayed awake and 3 of us who fell asleep. And I had totally different expectations for the journey. I thought, you know, we were going to be running around, just like looking at stuff and just, you know, having an experience. And we just fell asleep around the fire. And in a way, it was really peaceful to watch. But for me, I was getting frustrated because I'm like, why am I not feeling anything, even though I was like processing a lot of grief in my life, like processing a lot of people who had died in recent years, and that felt really good to just like let all that go. But then after a certain point, I felt like they wore off, and so I was getting frustrated. So I go up to the woman who the ceremony leader. I was like, "Where are the mushrooms? I need more." And she's like, over there. And so I ate more, and my friend actually made a chocolate pyramid with mushrooms in it, and so we were melting that, and I was just eating more mushrooms because I was like, I need to feel something. And then it started to hit me, and I had kind of a revelation, and the message that I was getting was that, you know, you don't need to have every lesson doesn't need to be a hard one. Mm. And subtlety is sometimes its own teacher. Mm. So I kind of interpreted that as meaning, you know, every mushroom trip you have doesn't have to be super intense and heavy and with all these visuals. And I was talking to my friend who was still up, and she was like, you know, sometimes the visuals, like all the hallucinations and things like that, are a distraction from what you really need to focus on. And that got me thinking about a lot of my trips in the past, how, you know, everyone's fascinated by the visuals.
I don't get visuals.
Oh, okay. What?
I don't have visuals.
Oh, my God. That's so hard to believe.
Yeah, I don't have visuals.
It's so interesting. It's so interesting hearing how different people are affected by mushrooms. You know, I've heard people who are like, oh, I take 3.5 grams and nothing happened. And
I had that the first time I did it. Yeah. I took 4 grams and nothing happened.
Oh, my God.
And then the first time I had something happen was I took 9 grams.
Oh, my God.
But then, you know, it's from different people. Mm-hmm. So then I found someone who 3.5 grams will do it for me. But then Kalindi talked about an access dose. Like, no matter how much I've taken, I've never left the room that I'm in. You know, I'm always in the room that I'm in, and
wow.
I'm having an experience, and I'm here. I have never gone to other places. Have you gone to other places?
Somewhat. I would say, yeah, somewhat. I've definitely gotten... feel like I've been transported sometimes, not for like the entire trip, but just for a brief moment. I remember one of my times I was in my hometown of Charleston, South Carolina, and we were out on James Island, which is one of the sea islands. So we were watching the sunset on the marsh. This is after we ate 3.5 grams, and I start seeing like King Tut and Nefertiti and all this like Egyptian imagery in the sun, and I was just like In a daze, like, I could not stop staring at the sun. And I was just like, whoa, is this really happening? And then we walk back to the house, and everything is fine. But then I start feeling nauseous. So I'm like, all right, guys, I need to throw up. So I go to vomit, and I start, like, hallucinating, looking at my vomit. And then I get, like, this vision of a woman, like, in... I guess it was Cuba. I don't know. That's what I'm guessing. But she was, like, wearing one of those, like, big flowy dresses, like, and I see other people with her, and they're, like, wearing red and white, and she's kind of laughing at me. She's like, ha-ha, like, I know you, like, she was, like, speaking Spanish, so I didn't know anything that she was saying, but the vibe that I got from her was, like, oh, like, you feel sick now, but you'll be fine, ha ha ha, like, you're good. And so that was kind of, I was just like hugging the toilet bowl smiling. And I'm like, okay, this is good, I feel better now. And my friends were kind of worried, like, do you need some water? And I was like, no, I'm good. But I kind of, it took that, you know, sometimes I wonder if that was like some of my ancestors, because my great-grandma was born and raised in Cuba, and so I'm like, maybe it's some connection there, or maybe it's just someone else, who knows, you know? But that was one of my experiences of, like, being transported just to a totally different place, hearing the music and the drumming and the dancing and seeing this woman who's, like, really vivacious and kind of just, like, laughing at me, but, like, not in a mean way, but just kind of like, oh, girl, you'll be fine, don't worry. So I always have instances like that on my trip where I get a message from someone like, you're going to be okay, don't worry. So, yeah.
It was making me thinking about, you were speaking about the traumas that you've experienced, and one of the things they talk about in indigenous-focused oriented therapy that they don't think of anybody as being broken.
Oh, okay.
If you have survived a trauma, you are considered someone who has indigenous wisdom, and you are someone we have to learn from because you survived it and you are here to tell the story. And I often think about that, about you know, the peoples of color of the world. The ones of us who were weak died. The ones of us who are here, we are the strong. We survived it. We have something in us to pass forward. You know, we know something about surviving trauma.
Oh, definitely. And especially us Black folks, you know, I studied history in college, and I grew up in Charleston where we still have plantations and stuff up and running. And, you know, sometimes I really, when I would be studying in college, I would really try to place myself in the shoes of my ancestors. And it was really hard for me because I was just like, I cannot imagine. I know the things that happened to them, but I cannot physically put myself there in that time, in that mindset. It's just so, I really think that you know, we've only scratched the surface in terms of like our ancestor stories and how they resisted and survived. So I'm just always in awe of how, you know, how their sacrifices made it so that we're here today.
And I feel one of those things for me, one of my pet peeves, I have many pet peeves, one of my pet peeves in the way we choose to tell the stories, even in the way we as Black people choose to tell the stories, I am so sick of seeing slaves in these beautiful costumes, in these beautiful cotton dresses. Mm-hmm. Cotton was king. You mm-hmm. was working to pick some damn cotton. They was not dressing no slaves in no cotton dresses. There was no dye. You was wearing right. burlap and mm-hmm. potato sacks mm-hmm. and you were half naked and you were barefoot mm-hmm. and that's why they could rape you all the time because you was just walking around half naked. And so mm-hmm. that to me is part of the thing that makes it hard for us to know the truth of our story right. because they prettify it. And it's right. like, it doesn't even make conscious sense that you're going to think that these people had on petticoats and right. things like that. No, maybe when you were in the house and you had to serve people.
Right, right.
But no, for the most part, you were half dressed and they walked us across the country barefoot mm-hmm. through snow as they, you know, moved us from Virginia into Texas. And, mm-hmm. you know, so I think that that is a place of where we don't even realize just how much strength we had mm-hmm. because they've covered over what the circumstances that yeah. we actually endured were.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think it's so empowering for us to be able to talk to our elders and to read testimonials from folks who were enslaved. My mom has a book series called I Was a Slave.
Your mother wrote it.
Oh, no, she has it at our house. That's
okay.
What I mean.
Okay.
But it's testimonies written by Black folks who were formerly enslaved, and it's really powerful to read directly from that. It's also really powerful to hear, you know, from folks like my grandma, who's 83, and I grew up with my great-grandma, and she passed in 2009 at the age of 97, but even before she passed, she was like, oh, yeah, my grandfather was a white man.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't really, we knew that there was some white ancestry there because she was one of the few lighter-skinned folks in my family. But it was, like, also a surprise. So I think there's a lot of power in being able to share our ancestors' stories and to talk to our elders and help keep their memory alive that way.
That was part one of my conversation with Ife Tayo Harvey from the Drug Policy Network and People of Color Psychedelic Collective. Come back for part two.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.